Building the fashion businesses of the future together. Welcome to the future of fashion business. The future of fashion business is about helping aspiring fashion entrepreneurs and designers start their own successful fashion brands by learning from the best, most experienced people in the industry. I am your host, Esteban Julian. For more advice and to learn more about how I started my own fashion brand, make sure you follow my fashion journey on YouTube at Esteban Julian. Hello, and welcome to this week's episode of The Future of Fashion Business. I am your host, Esteban Julian, and here with me today, I have Oscar Erickson. Now, Oscar is the co-founder and director of business development at Nighten.com. Nighten is a subsidiary brand of H&M that was created to appeal to young people by working with influencers and celebrities. With that being said, I'm sure you do a whole lot better job than I will introducing what Nighten actually is. But Oscar, I can't thank you enough for being here with us today, man.
Well, thank you so much for having me. It's my pleasure completely.
Amazing, amazing. Well, Oscar, that being said, because I'm super, super interested into diving deep into what Nighten actually is and what it actually does, can you give us a little bit more can you give us a little bit more information on what Nighten is and what it does?
Yeah, sure. So Nighten is and was sort of a result from many years of data science and innovation in relation to fashion and retail in general. So Nighten is nowadays the incubator hub for all the celebrity collaborations that H&M are doing, basically. Started out as sort of my baby a few years ago together with a co-founder. It is one thing that is sort of a result of so what we did basically was I can take you from a short sort of beginning at the H&M era where we many years ago built the innovation lab in H&M basically. So H&M was a very as most big retail companies are or have been for the past 20 years, sort of a traditional fashion house where you had the seasons and you had a view of what would be in demand for the coming sort of years. So what we did when we started out a couple of years ago was to start looking at data in a new way. So we built what then was called the Advanced Analytics Lab and the Data Science Innovation Hub, where we basically broke down retail in a bunch of different sort of aspects, 24, 25, like core aspects of retail, everything from trend detection to production to distribution to online algorithms, pricing algorithms, basically everything you could imagine retail being all about. And then we tested those sort of theses out in the real world in small pilot tests. So what we did was basically to build an infrastructure and a hub for innovating fast and scaling fast. And after a couple of years, we started to asking ourselves much more sort of philosophical questions. Where is the society going? And wouldn't it be cool to really understand where creativity comes from and what actually creates engagement in different digital and physical worlds? And I think there was one sort of magical day when my co-founder, he started asking like, well, look at the music industry. Look what happens when something goes viral or something becomes popular within music. It's basically a studio that has all the fundamentals and tools for creating a good song. So you have the beats and you have the pianos, you have all the instruments, and what is needed basically is a few creative and talented souls just meeting up together and creating something. And everything that becomes popular nowadays is most often a meeting between different souls and different people with different audiences. So that cross collaboration becomes interesting for a bigger part of the world. So we asked ourselves, is it a possibility to create fashion or create style in the same way as music is created? So we spent a few years building this kind of lab in Los Angeles with a small hub here in Sweden as well. And Our music studio basically was a big library of, you know, the best garments, the best silhouettes, sort of fundament for anyone who wanted to come in and create their own line. And what we really were passionate about was to go beyond the fashion industry and actually invite people who recently have been present in a sports vertical or in the music industry or in the movie industry or arts or skate or whatever to put their magical touch on our sort of foundation. So Nidin was a super, super exciting project. I think it showed a new way to distribute fashion and to sort of move away from the traditional seasons and much more walk into a world of what happens when a creative soul gets to try out a new hobby, basically. And we were that sort of platform that could facilitate that hobby, me being design your own clothing line and getting it produced in such a good sort of condition as H&M could facilitate with their power in the reach and distribution. Mm-hmm. So that was a super fun project, and I think a lot of the learnings and a lot of the strategies that were fundamental for building Nidin have been taken with, you know, transitioned into what I do now in a lot of different companies. So when it comes to hacking viral growth or speaking from a value-driven platform out to different target markets around the world. So that was a super exciting period.
Awesome. No, and I can imagine it was super. No wonder, because to be honest, you think of H&M, and for example, the first thing that I think about is, yeah, what you just said, music or artists, or think about the people that actually represent and live the brand itself. And I'm guessing it was, most of it was part of a massive result because of projects like Nidin, which it makes it quite fascinating, to be honest with you. Now, how did you end up there in the first place? And obviously, how did you end up where you are right now? What's sort of your story and your background?
Where to start? So for some reason, I entered into the fashion industry a long time ago. I think it was 10 years ago. To be completely frank, I was never particularly passionate about fashion. I just ended up in that sort of situation a long time ago where I work with the global expansion when it comes to expanding the global store network in the H&M group, back at the time where physical stores were actually a sign of growth of the business, and not only as we view physical stores today, which is more of a touch point to give a customer an experience for then going online and doing the real shopping there. Even though we have a big chunk of commerce in the physical world still. But that was way back. So growing a physical store network in different parts of the world. Then I went back and forth a bit within the entrepreneurial field and did some other things and came back to H&M just to build this new way of looking at data. So the scope was really, how can we create models and algorithms and a data lake that allows the whole organization to respond to the demands of a market in 30 and 40 and 50 years ahead in time. So that was basically a journey where we asked super difficult questions to a huge amount of data and transformed that into models. Nidin being one result of those sort of findings. Nowadays, I do a bunch of different stuff. Mainly, it all always comes back to digital strategies, how to create growth in companies that are both in the forefront of digital to take that growth to the next level, but also taking companies that have previously gone from, you know, maybe an editorial background or a very physical background. So how do we take all that value that has been built from their way of working into a digital space? And I mean, I think there are some macro trends that I can talk about that sort of lays the foundation to why growth, at least, I mean, especially viral growth, the kind of growth that you don't pay for, because everyone could do, of course, Facebook marketing and Instagram marketing and paid influencer marketing, but there's a next level growth that only comes from being truly organic and understanding viral loops and viral networks. Because as I used to say, the internet is like a bar, you know, and all the companies, they try to be the coolest guy in the bar and they try to do whatever you need to do to be cool, but really it's just a random event, you know, random series of events that's happening, and someone shows something cool and someone buys a nice drink or someone does something crazy and people get excited about it. And that's how internet works. So it's seemingly just a mess and it's seemingly just the randomness of happening, but there are mechanics in that randomness that you could sort of model, and you can not control it, but you can work in a smart way where you create more and more virality around your concept. And once you've hacked that, you can build a traffic pattern and an audience that will listen to your brand much more than if you just, you know, pay for your marketing. So right Amazing. Now I'm doing all that based in Stockholm and traveling around a bit to where I need to be, basically.
Awesome. No, and that's extremely important nowadays, because obviously you see a lot of things like, you know, as you mentioned, Facebook advertising, paid traffic strategies, Instagram advertising, a lot of influencer strategies going on. And you're, as a brand, you have to start thinking that, okay, so because of the nature of competition, because obviously everybody that can do it right now is doing it, there's going to be a point where that becomes saturated as well. It's just the natural process of any digital, any marketing strategy, really. So what you're saying is that as a brand, you need to find ways to stand out from the competition and actually figure out solid strategies that are going to build those relationships with their customers for them to last a long period of time, instead of, you know, being here today and then just disappearing tomorrow, right?
Yeah, definitely. And I think just to take a step back or to sort of highlight a bit, I think there are two major trends that are sort of steering this whole world forward. And I think, first of all, we see a world where the power structures have been changed. I mean, we have gone from, you know, having kings and churches and priests talking to farmers and, you know, you have to pay taxes this and this way. And then we had in the era where, you know, the presidents and the big corporations had the power, which they still to some extent do, but where the actual power lies nowadays is what, you know, some people call netocrats, some people call viral nodes, people in the digital space that actually have a strong following and a strong power because of their value-driven behavior and how they talk and how they sort of move towards the future. And I mean, it's not to say that they are only influencers or whatever, but netocrats could be anyone who stands for something and people actually trust that individual or that group of individuals. So that's, I think, where the real power lies. And I think that where we see the other major sort of cost for working in a new way is that there's a polarization, especially in fashion, but in retail in general, where the polarization touches purchasing behavior and you know, what destinations you go to for different kind of purchases. And this polarization, it stems from two types of purchases being made, where we have one being commodity, you know, the boring buys, my black t-shirts, my maybe underwear if I don't care about it, you know, salt, pepper, diapers, batteries, whatever. And these boring buys, I mean, we've already seen it, that the big platforms are taking sort of 60, 70, 80% market share, because why wouldn't you just do your commodity purchasing on sort of like a subscription-based platform or where it's just the low price? It's very price-driven and commodity-driven. And then you have the other end of the spectrum where purchases are being made with your heart and your soul. And you have passion and emotions about a certain product or a certain brand or a cause that is very connected to that product or brand. So a consequence of this polarization being made is, number one, that everything that is in the middle, sort of the identity crisis brands that both try to fight on price but also try to be a brand, I think we're going to see an increased death rate of these kind of brands, to be blunt. And what's also happening is that we see a spike of these direct-to-consumer brands or D2C brands that everyone wants to talk about now. And these are brands that are basically, I mean, I guess they're common in all parts of the world, but you sort of cut out the middleman, you can create your own products or your own brands, you can market them however you want to, and you can do it on your Shopify solution store. So it all sounds really great, but every single one of these brands, they have basically the same problem. I mean, no matter if they're just a startup or if they have reached some kind of scale, they need to drive traffic, because if you cut out the middleman, that is often, you know, a retailer or someone that gives you a spread of reach. Now you have to take care of that reach yourself. So, I mean, not even taking into account the machinery of your daily content production that you need. The big problem is, how do I get the reach? How do I go outside the filter bubbles? As you know, I don't know if we need to explain what filter bubbles is, but basically the limit to the target audience that you can reach with your current messaging. How do I expand beyond that into new demographics? And yeah, exactly. And when you try to do that, that quickly becomes pretty expensive, because you have a duopoly today on digital traffic. So Google and Facebook and their networks, they own like 70% plus of all the paid traffic online. And when you have a duopoly in the society, we all know that prices tend to increase. So with more and more people fighting for the same target audiences by paid ads and cost per click strategies, all of these direct-to-consumer companies see their traffic costs and acquisition costs, they become too high for a customer lifetime value. And that's a super difficult equation to solve. And there really is only one way to solve it, two ways. Either you're super lucky and your brand becomes viral for some weird reason, or you actually have a super, super strong and super powerful long-term strategy for viral growth. And you can complement that strategy with paid advertising as well, of course. But I think those are the two major sort of trends we're seeing, except for, you know, the sustainability trends and other things happening with influencers becoming their own shop fronts and stuff like that with new technologies. But in general, I would say that the power structures have moved down to netocrats, and we see a bigger polarization of either a platform behavior or direct-to-consumer brands that are super niche and can become super successful, but the traffic costs are just eating up most profits today.
Okay, so that's super, super interesting. So how could you, because you mentioned most, obviously I'm guessing, and I'm sure a lot of the people that are starting out and want to start their own fashion brands find it a lot more attractive to become one of those, you know, business to consumer brands so that they can pretty much have more control over the whole process. But as you said, most of them, because of the lack of having a viral growth strategy, a strategy that's going to make them unique and is going to make their customers relate with them as a brand, usually die out. Now, I'm not sure what the percentage is, but as you said, I'm sure it's pretty much most of them. What could be some of the basics? And obviously I know viral strategy can be a lot of information to talk about in one episode, but what would be the basics or the pillars of starting a brand that could actually succeed in a business to consumer model?
Yeah, sure. I mean, let's limit that to the pillars of the viral growth, because I think otherwise I will forget too many things to talk about and people will think I'm an idiot. So when we talk about viral growth or viral loops, I would say we could divide that discussion into two different sort of strategies. First of all, you have, what are we doing as a brand internally to create, to transform our customers to brand advocates? So what is happening after the purchase? Normally after a purchase, that's where you start your viral loop. Something needs to happen where you benefit from doing as the brand tells you to do, whether that is, you know, sharing your unboxing experience or sharing your experience of the purchasing journey or doing something where you actually tell the world that, hey, this brand is great and I bought this product because of this and this and this. And usually you need to involve some emotional factors there, not only commercial ones. The other side of a viral strategy is getting the world to talk about your brand in a way that you want to. And then instead of doing, for example, influencer campaigns, which, I mean, to be honest, an influencer campaign is exactly the same thing as a Facebook ad campaign, but with pretty much lower click-through rate and less results in the short run. So instead of working with influencers as a viral tool, what I usually propose or what I like, one sort of format that I use is that we work with brand heroes long-term instead. Number one, because when people that have influence, when these digital netocrats who have influence, when they talk about something long-term, it means that they trust the brand and the product in a deeper sense than only, okay, here's a new product, go and buy it. It creates much more of an advocacy around the brand. And number two, it just becomes much better for your business results. That we see that over and over again. And I think what's important when we work with these viral nodes, or call them ambassadors or influencers, whatever you want to call them, people around the world who talk about your brand, and they allow you to step back as a brand and talk about your values and your ethos and your why, and you can let these other people in the society talk about specific products. That's usually much more relevant than you as a brand promoting your own product. But then you need to understand what is actually driving these people, because there's no such thing as a free lunch. I mean, no one would just do something for you as a brand.
For free, exactly. Especially if you're starting out, if you have no money, you know?
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, I never pay ambassadors. I never pay brand heroes or anything. What we do is that we try to find their motivational drivers to do as we want them to do and work with us in a way that we want them to work with us. So usually you have four main sort of things that people are driven by when they are someone who spreads your message. And that's the first one being association metrics, where association means if someone else is also talking about this, then I should probably be talking about this too. So for example, if you would do something next to Rihanna, you would feel pretty cool. Or if I would do something next to David Beckham, I would also feel pretty cool. So association metrics that you use for to actually have more people than one, a network of people talking about things together. I think that's a huge factor. Second one being a bit more sort of techie and nerdy, which is called vanity metrics. So if I can help, if we as a brand can help our brand heroes or ambassadors to get more engagement and more likes and more comments, which is their sort of bread and butter, then they will probably be more likely to help us with spreading our messaging. So vanity metrics is sort of like how much exposure, how much attention do I get if I work with this brand? The third thing is a huge thing, I think, and that's pretty much my main currency nowadays, and that's content. So the same way that all of the brands in the world have a problem with, you know, we need to produce content every single day, and we need to find ways to distribute this content every single day. Guess what? The same problem is existing among these environments as well. Exactly. So if we can help them with content, if we can say to them, well, we have this badass idea right now, we have this value-driven discussion that we want to help you talk about, when we'll support you in giving you, you know, videos, imagery, whatever, maybe write an article, do something that creates content for both parties. That's a huge thing to use. Way more valuable than money in most situations. And the last thing I would say relates a bit to vanity metrics and content, but it's exposure. So if we can sort of offer exposure to new audiences, let's say that we want to talk about, so we have a great example. Just 2 weeks ago, we helped an app. It's an app that is for riders and the adventure people and skiers, basically. And it's called Protect Our Winders. It's a very value-driven thing where we wanted to find people who were passionate about making the winters come back every winter. So stopping global warming and, you know, having these discussions and these call to actions about the climate change. And we were very focused on Scandinavia in this very campaign. But what we did was that we started talking to ambassadors and future brand heroes in other parts of the world. So we did it in Tokyo, we did it in the USA, we did it a bit of here and there. And what was interesting is that we could actually give them exposure into new demographics, because we have a seat somewhere else than their target audience. So that's also a huge thing to offer. Like, how can we help you reach new audiences with your messaging if you help us with our messaging? So yeah, that's it's basically a framework for identifying these viral nodes and understanding how to motivate them. And then the last question then becomes, so what do you actually do together with them? And I think a very, very sort of pragmatic way of looking at it is that you as a brand, of course, hopefully you have some values and some discussions going on that you want to drive forward, because you shouldn't only exist just to sell clothes or to do something like, you know, that is completely commercial. Probably you have also something that you actually are passionate about. So those passions, whether it being, you know, the environment or equality or innovation or whatever, there's always going on discussions about every single subject online. And what you can do is that you can match your sort of voice and your ethos with what's going on online. And when you understand that, you can understand. So who are the top 10, 20, 50, 100 opinion leaders or influencers within this discussion or this matter? So let's say you want to talk about innovation or like fatherhood, like what does it mean to be a present father nowadays? There are discussions going on about that online. And you can quickly do some analytics and some manual sort of scanning and understand, okay, there are a few people here who are actually driving this discussion forward. Let's team up with them and talk together. So I think it's all about matching what you want to say as a company, and you look online and you look in the physical world and you understand what kind of discussions and what kind of themes are actually emerging right now and who are leading these discussions. And you can do that by going deep, you know, crawling forums. You can do backlink analytics on posts. You can be extremely technical, or you can be extremely manual and just, you know, going super pragmatic, just searching a hashtag. Who is talking about this? Who is driving most traffic about this? And then you team up with them, and then you do cool stuff with them. And I think that's a much more fun way to work with viral nodes than just, you know, hey, we have a budget, let's do an influencer campaign, and then you get super disappointed, because an influencer campaign is almost never ROI positive, you know, the first time. It's first when the same person talks about your cause or your brand 5, 6, 7 times. That's when you start to get leverage on that kind of spread. Because when someone says something one time, you know, the noise in social media nowadays is just insane. 98% of everything that is posted on Instagram is never even getting a like. It just gets lost in the feed. So you need to reappear all the time, and it's much cooler and much more efficient to reappear within the same feed or the same context or the same human being than to just try different stuff all the time.
And now, we'd like to take a quick commercial break to thank our sponsors. This podcast is sponsored by Your Social Component. At Your Social Component, we help fashion and e-commerce business owners automate and scale their online sales using the best online advertising strategies out there. If you're looking for a marketing agency that completely understands your industry and can scale your fashion and e-commerce business to the next level, make sure you get in touch through our website at yoursocialcomponent.com. Now let's continue with this week's episode.
No, it makes perfect sense. And I have to completely agree with you. I mean, you see the amount of noise that's going on. I mean, you have to stop and think, how am I going to be different, especially as a business? Because that just makes it even more difficult. What would be your best advice in terms of obviously growing through viral systems and getting in touch with people that can represent your business in a sustainable way? But for brands that might be starting out, or you know, they might not have the amount of they might not be able to offer the amount of exposure like some other big brands would do, what would be the best thing for them to do, or what would be the best thing for them to focus on so they could, you know, take it a little bit like one step at a time and grow a little bit more from that barrier that most brands aren't able to cross?
So I think it's a super relevant question, and I think there's some very easy answer to it if you don't want to be fancy, and I like not being fancy. So what I would do basically is to just do exactly the same thing as major corporations do nowadays, but you scale it down to your level. So if you're just starting out, we all know the power of micro influencers. We know that micro influencers have much higher engagement and they charge much less than influencers that have reached sort of a critical point in their following. So mm-hmm. I would reach out to micro influencers and I would be super pragmatic and tell them that we have this brand X, we stand for Y. We want to do this and we want to drive this discussion forward and we want to provide a super good product to the world. But like, be super transparent, and you have to have a value discussion going on, because the world doesn't need another sneaker just like for the sake of it. The world needs things that speak to causes and that speak to a bigger sort of discussion than only the clothing. So I would approach nodes and influencers that just have a smaller following, and I would barter deal with them. I would give them something in return for talking about my brand in a very cool way. And mm-hmm. I think that you can, if you're smart enough and if you have a big enough pipeline, you can get as much leverage and traffic from working with 50 viral nodes that have between, you know, 1,000 and 2,000 followers than to work with a few ones that have 50 or 100,000, because they will, either way, they will get lost in the noise, and the smaller ones, they might actually care to make better content with you and to actually, you know, have an interest in growing themselves. Mm-hmm. So that's one thing that I would really go all in on, you know, nurturing relationships with growing accounts that have a track record of actually getting high engagement rates, but that are small enough so they won't, you know, just treat you as a corporate partner, or they, you know, just charge you money for doing something with them. Never pay them. I wouldn't do that in the beginning.
Well, yeah, of course, because that's also a sign that they don't believe in your product as much as they should do, right? Especially if you're dealing with micro influencers. You know, if you cannot persuade, if you can't make a micro influencer believe in the brand that you're offering them, that's a sign that you still have a lot of work to do from your end. From maybe they don't like the product, or maybe the branding is not quite right. Right?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, yeah, I think that summarizes pretty well.
Of course, and it takes it back to what you said previously about having your own brand identity. It's not good enough to just try to jump into the, you know, the hype train and try to do what everything is doing, but it's very important to know and believe and be passionate, as you said, about what distinguishes you as a brand, and get in touch with people that really live and breathe what your brand stands for.
Yeah, I mean, the world is big enough. And it, at least in the digital space, it's still growing. So there are enough accounts out there, and there are enough people out there that can speak about your brand in an authentic way. It takes time to find them. You need to work through a lot of dialogues and a lot of manual work. But I think doing that is, I mean, I've tried all different aspects of this, and doing it manually, doing it with, you know, a voice and a heart and telling them that we want to do something together with you, we want to do it long term, it's always going to be much more impactful and efficient than, you know, just I'm not trying to ruin anyone's business here, but then just, you know, getting a subscription on an influencer platform, upload a campaign, choose 2,000 influencers, tell them what hashtags to use, tell them exactly what to write, and then go live with it. Because
meaningless transaction.
Yeah, I mean, it might be a good way to get some awareness and to get your name out there, but doing things manually is definitely the way. And I think I would also take advantage of the fact that if I were just starting out, I can actually do the things that don't scale and I don't lose anything. I mean, if I'm too big, every day counts, every dollar spent counts. You know, you have the staff, you have your operations, you have so much to do. So you need to automate things. But when you're starting out, you can actually use that as an advantage and tell yourself that now is the time to do the things that don't scale. I think we look at Airbnb, for example. It's a beautiful example of how they used the first year to just doing things that don't scale. They gave the first 50 or 100 users a super like 10-star rating experience. Like, how does that look like? And they invested in making great content and going to the apartments and the buildings and actually shooting them in a really, really nice way. I mean, obviously they can't really do that with a couple of million accounts, but when you're small, you can still do things and create an amazing experience for your first 50, 100, and 1,000 fans. I think a great book to read about this, I forget the name, but I think 1,000 true fans is sort of like the starting point for anyone who wants to grow grow with the first users, because there's no one else that can talk about your brand as people who have actually bought your product, of course.
Mm-hmm. Awesome. No, that's amazing. And I can only 100% agree with it. I mean, again, you have to find people that believe in what you do. Because it's like when you have friends, think of it of having friends, you know, if you have a product that not even your friend will believe in, that just pretty much says what you still have to do with your product. On the other hand, if you have a product and your five friends really believe that, then you know for sure that they're going to tell their friends and their family and et cetera, et cetera. And that's the same sort of strategy that you have to learn how to apply online.
Sure, I completely agree. And I think that we're seeing, coming back to what we talked about in the beginning about the co-creation and the excitement today with co-creation, I think there's another thing in related to that, and that's the participatory society. We see a huge trend in the world. I mean, we have for some time. I'm late to the party when it comes to Burning Man and the things like that. the participatory element is super interesting, and I think we're going to see a lot more of that in both the physical and in the digital world. So being small, I mean, coming back to this challenge of being small, because that's the most difficult part. We don't need to talk about when it becomes easy. Mm-hmm. Being small also allows you to actually gather feedback from your first customers and your first users. So I would also be super transparent in saying to them that, look, we are still in the phase where we're trying to figure out the best way to create this product, or we are in this phase where we try to figure out what color should we have on our sneakers for the fall drop. Should we include pink, or should we include a pattern, or should we do something with the product? You guys, our first 500 followers or our first 1,000 users, you get to actually decide what we're doing next. So you can use that to your advantage as well, and you can talk to a small audience and let them participate in your product development, whether you're doing an app that needs improvement or you're doing a clothing line that could have different, as I mentioned, colors or patterns next fall or whatever. And that also creates an element of, you know, if I have this close connection to the brand and I've actually affected the brand in a way, or I've been part of creating something, of course I want to tell my friends about it, because who don't want to be that cool guy or cool girl who actually did something that is now online in the way that I contributed to it? So I think you can talk to that sort of emotional part of a consumer as well, where they actually get to become co-creators at scale. I mean, I think that's a super new thing we see right now, and we can do it in our phone, we can do it in a lot of different media.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so and it not only helps you as a brand to build that relationship with your customer, but also ensures you that in the future you're going to build better products, because you, at the end of the day, you're doing what your customers want.
Sure. And I think we're talking online only right now. I think that there's sort of a misconception in the retail industry, and specifically I think in the fashion industry, where we talk about this massive death of retail, and I think you need to retail watch your words. Yeah, exactly. And I mean, yes, it's happening and malls go under, but what happens is that bad retail is dying and wrongfully purposed retail is dying. So retail that is supposed to just drive massive sales and is located in weird places, sure, that's dying. But retail as a destination is not dying. It depends on how do you use it and what kind of purpose do you have with it. If I had the budget as a small niche brand, I would seriously consider having a pop-up store or a retail space simply for meeting my client or customer in the real world. You know, you could showcase stuff, you could create an experience, you can have events and stuff from which you can create content that you can use online. And we also see in all the data from like 50 years ago to now, at least now since the start of internet, that in those geographical locations where a brand has a higher physical presence, they always do better online sales and online profitability. So there's something to your digital traffic and your digital awareness that gets positively affected by having a physical presence as well. And I mean, it can be expensive with the space, granted the space, the rents are going down due to this retail apocalypse, but you don't always need a full retail space. You can be present at a lot of different touch points in society to drive traffic to your digital web store as well. So I would seriously,
yeah, I mean, you could just have a little stand on the street. That should be better than nothing, you know, if you don't have the money for it.
You can sell some lemonade as well if you want to. but I think that in every single digital strategy or viral strategy, whether it's you know, an ad network or a YouTube strategy or your own social media or influencers, you should always have in back of your head what are we doing in the physical world to either drive things to this strategy or capture things in the physical world. I mean, there's no coincidence that, you know, the most viral brands in the world the last 7 or 8 or 10 years, they've all stemmed from at least storytelling about the physical place. You know, you have Calabasas in Los Angeles, you have Silver Lake, and you have, like, you know, the small headquarters of Virgil Abloh. It's all storytelling about physical places, and they don't need to be set in stone for 10 years time. I think it's only interesting that they are changing and that they are moving, and you create sort of a those who know basically sort of a narrative about that physical place. So I think that it's sort of been forgotten in what else is a huge digital transformation, but I would suggest you take a step back and seriously consider it. What are we doing in the physical world to complement this whole fancy digital viral strategy?
Awesome. No, that's awesome. Now, before we end up the episode, before we wrap everything up, there's a question I do really want to ask you, and it's probably not going to be an easy one to answer to, just because, I mean, you can't really know for sure at the end of the day, but where do you think this is all going? Where do you see this? Do you see this viral, these viral growth strategies and these viral systems being relevant in 5 to 10 years from now? And if not, what do you think is going to be the most important thing to keep in mind?
No, I think it's going to stay the same, and I'm just going to take it easy now for 10 years. I'm just joking. I think what we're seeing is that as with the polarization of purchasing behavior, we will see a polarization of viral nodes. So I think that the influencers, if we call them that, I think either they will become sort of obsolete because they live and thrive on narcissism. And I think, or I hope, narcissism and, you know, shining a light on yourself is the trend that will decrease the coming years. So I think we will see a much more sort of honest way of talking to your followers, less sort of perfect vacations, perfect mornings, perfect meals. I think we're going to see a trend of much more brutal, rough. Yeah. And I really look forward to that trend, if it's correct. The second thing that I think is that... Sorry?
No, go ahead.
Yeah, and I think that the second thing is, of course, new technologies like, you know, what Instagram, what they're developing right now, and a technology that I'm working with a company here in Stockholm, we will see that the storefront and the content feed will sort of be merged. So I don't think that you will see a difference between an Instagram picture or a story and what used to be like a product or a storefront. And I think that that will create a wave of those viral nodes and those netocrats or opinion leaders that actually have a strong following and that actually trust them on recommendations and on trends. They will become their own brands in a much higher extent. So we see it, you know, with big sports stars. We see it with people like Kylie Jenner building like a huge business with only 6 people. More and more so, because technology is going to be so easy to implement in your social account, so that you will be able to start your own brand, basically, and talk to your audience directly. You won't need to be doing sponsor deals and stuff like that. If you have enough reach and if you have enough trust among your target audience, I think that's a super clear trend that that we're seeing. So and for all things virality and growth, I think that, you know, what changes in the world is the technology, but humans to most part, they're roughly the same. I mean, I love when Andrew Chen talks about growth, and he always used this example of the first coupon code that was created. I think it was Colgate or some other toothpaste company that took an ad in a magazine, maybe 1940s, 1930s, 1950s, maybe. And that coupon had the same sort of call to action, the same sort of urgency, the same motivation, the same social proof, all these things that we put together in a conversion formula to create excitement and to create a feeling of urgency among an audience. It has the same elements of that, but, you know, you have to take the coupon and go to a store. So I think that we're seeing that human beings, we trust other human beings, and we trust things when they are scarce and when they become cool, no matter if it's a new band or a movement or whatever it is. Historically, human beings, we actually get triggered and we get excited by roughly the same mechanisms. It's just that the technology changes. So back to your question, I think that what will happen is that we will have different platforms, different technologies, of course, augmented reality, virtual reality, all that cool stuff. So we'll just have to adapt to what people are actually using and where the attention is actually heading. But the fundamental drivers of, you know, doing something or acting in a way or sharing something, I think they're pretty much the same. So everything I talk about here is like, nothing is new when it comes to behavior. It's just like using the right tools and the right platforms to work with it, to be honest. Mm-hmm. Does that make sense?
No, really? Yeah, no, perfect sense. Perfect sense. And yeah, I mean, technology's changed, but human connections will be the most important thing. They have been for ever since we started existing, and most likely they'll continue to be, unless, you know, there's a technology that even stops that. But I doubt that will happen soon anyway. You know, but Phil, that was a monster of an episode. That's a monster of an episode. Really, really good episode. A lot of content. I think it's actually the the longest one we've had so far, which says a lot of good things about the amount of content that you shared with us, Oscar. So, man, I can't thank you enough for sharing all that.
Yeah, likewise. I think it was a super interesting discussion, and it usually becomes very philosophical, but that's where I like to head up. Thank you so much for having me.
No, it's my pleasure. Now, for our listeners, what would be a good place to try and get in touch with you? And I don't know if you do any consulting or do you offer any services for people that might want to be reaching out to you?
Sure. I mean, I do some consulting, and I do it in sort of like a portfolio format where we take both like equity and we do also retainer fees. We don't do any marketing so far because all the clients we have basically come from our own networks, and we try to keep it sort of small. But you could always reach me at my Instagram. You may be able to share that later somehow. But yeah. I'm open awesome. To get in touch with people, but it's not something that I focus on too much.
Awesome. Yeah, so I'll just make sure I put your Instagram profile on the description. Hopefully this podcast will be trendy enough in the future for you to have a couple of thousands of followers due to this episode.
That is amazing. Thank you so much.
Awesome. Thank you, Oscar. Thank you very much.
All right, take care.
If you want to learn even more about how you can start your own fashion brand, make sure you follow me on YouTube at Esteban Julian. Thank you for listening to this week's episode of The Future of Fashion Business. Make sure you subscribe to listen to our future episodes.